Forget the pressure to overhaul your life. The new year doesn't need a new you. It needs you. Grounded, supported, and ready to grow. Grow Therapy helps you make meaningful change at your pace and on your time. Whether it's your first time in therapy or your 50th, Grow makes it easier to find a therapist who fits you, not the other way around. They connect you with thousands of independent, licensed therapists across the U.S., offering both virtual and in-person sessions, nights, and weekends. You can search by what matters, like insurance, specialty, identity, or availability, to get started in as little as 2 days. And if something comes up, you can cancel up to 24 hours in advance at no cost. There are no subscriptions and no long-term commitments. You just pay per session. Grow helps you find therapy on your time. Whatever challenges you're facing, Grow Therapy is here to help. Grow accepts over 100 insurance plans, including Medicaid, in some states. Sessions average about $21 with insurance, and some pay as little as $0, depending on their plan. Visit growtherapy.com/get started today to get started. That's growtherapy.com/get started. growtherapy.com/get started. Availability and coverage vary by state and insurance plan.
I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello and welcome to episode number 16 of Comics Corner. I'm Harry, joined as always by Connor. And yes, your eyes do not deceive you. This is one where I'm hosting, and that's because this was my idea. As always, I've dragged Connor back into the land of the East, the land of the rising sun, which, ironically enough, he's actually been to.
I love Japan. I just don't like people who make loving Japan their entire identity.
No, that's absolutely fair, and you're correct to do so. Such people should be shamed and bullied. I've mentioned it a number of times. I was once handed an umbrella by a friend of mine, well, an acquaintance of mine, that had a samurai sword hilt handle. And I felt like beating him and doing a rock and turning it sideways. It's very embarrassing. But I wanted to appreciate and examine the work of Junji Ito, probably the most well-known and famous, in the West at least, mangaka of horror that we have over here. Loads and loads of his material has been translated into English now. He was the person who introduced me to horror manga. And I think this is the first time we've done an episode focused specifically on a horror author or horror comics in general.
We do have... others lined up and in the works.
This is true.
When we can get round to it.
And obviously Berserk had a lot of horror elements, but is a very broad story that covers a lot of different genres, you could say, or at least it taps into. Ito's work is unapologetically horror-focused from the beginning, and we thought we'd focus on primarily the short stories contained in Shiver, which, if I remember correctly, was the first short story collection of his released in the West in English. Then we're going to focus on Uzumaki and Gyo. Now, initially, I hadn't intended to cover Gyo because I hadn't actually read it myself, but Connor, being the overachiever that he is, decided that he was going to read the entire thing when I lent it to him so he could read The Enigma of Amigara Fault, which is an extra story contained at the back of it. And I must say, having read it, I'm very glad that you did so because it was a worthwhile experience and there's a lot of discussion that we can take from it. So for those of you unfamiliar, Junji Ito is, of course, a horror author, a horror comics writer, an artist who's very famed for his wonderful, creepy, disgusting, uneasy artwork that he produces for all of his stories. You can see on our wonderful video wall that our editors have put together a selection of the work that he's done. Yes, directly behind me is one that we'll get on to.
Why did they pick that one?
Because they wanted to punish us, I assume. He's widely known for all of his artwork. He's heavily influenced by other horror manga authors from Japan, like Kazuo Umez, who I think through Ito's influence, has his work, my missus absolutely loves horror manga. So she's the one who gets all of the Ito stuff after I introduced her to him. And Kazuo Umez, because of Ito's influence, has been introduced to the West as well. And his work is being translated. And I've got a few of his that I need to read, but I know that he was the first author that Ito read. And he decided from that point that he wanted to try and to try his own hand. He's also a former dental technician, which is interesting. And because actually he's said in a number of interviews that he has been helped in his craft through his experience in that, because it helps him to stick to a deadline and also to fashion his pens and implements to be exactly what he needs to make them as easy as possible to use. And you know what? If you want to be able to do this sort of artwork, yeah, you want to be in complete control of it. And yeah, he's just an author who has become very, very popular in the West, and I think for a good reason. This, I believe, is the first time that you have been introduced to him. Were you aware of him before I suggested this?
Before you brought his name up about a year ago in the list of ideas that we've got bouncing around, no, I hadn't read his stuff. My missus is actually complete opposite to you. We started watching some of the adaptations on Netflix, the Maniac series from 2018.
Yeah, well, there's the Collection series from 2018 and Maniac, which I believe was last year, 2023.
Oh, sorry, yes. We started watching Maniac. We watched the inflatable head balloons one that is included in Shiver.
And one of his more famous ones.
She refuses to watch any of the rest, so I had to watch it all on my own.
It is very disturbing. I think that's one of the appeals of Junji Ito's artwork and his stories, is not just the fact that, yes, he can create some truly gruesome images, but also the stories often have a deeper allegorical meaning that can be read into them and also are purely disturbing in a very psychological sense as well. And that's something that I was talking to Samson about before we came on. When you watch interviews with Junji Ito, which I did for in the preparation for this, he comes across as a really mild-mannered, unassuming, friendly gentleman who keeps a lot of his cards close to his chest when he discusses where he comes up with these ideas from. Because, of course, we'll get into some of the political interpretations that can come from it. But most of the interpretations that I found online, appropriately, given that most of the people who analyze this stuff are progressives, tend to be progressive readings, left-wing, leftist readings of his work. He himself has kept his cards very close to his chest. I can't really find anything of his where he talks about his own politics, but I do think that he is definitely reflective of Japanese culture and Japanese themes, and his work could only really exist or make sense within a Japanese context.
He also traverses skillfully, for the most part, three different horror genres, which is cosmic, sort of unknowable, eldritch, Lovecraftian style horror, body horror, which is the most visceral stuff, and then monsters. Monsters, I'm thinking like the fashion model short
yes.
story. And I think actually the adaptations, because I've read all of these stories and also watched both series, and I know there's an Uzumaki anime
coming out
September.
Next month.
Yes.
From when we're recording this, which I'm actually really looking forward to, because the trailer makes it look very good. It's using, an artful use of 3D animation in some places, which can be very hit and miss, including in the Hanging Balloon adaptation. There's some 3D, which doesn't look that great and doesn't mesh that well. But the director they've got for it, let me get my notes up here, who is a man called Hiroshi Nagahama, seems to be very skilled and is being very respectful. It's got a seal of approval from Ito. It's all being done in grayscale and black and white, as he would want. And also has music being composed by Colin Stetson, who's the man who composed the music for Hereditary, the 2017 horror film. And I'm a big fan of that film, so I'm hoping that it all meshes together quite well, because as an audiovisual experience, I think Uzumaki could be something really special. There have been some live action adaptations of it.
It's a 2000s movie, yes.
Which I've seen some clips from, which don't do it justice.
Well, part of the problem as well is that it was being developed and shot while the manga was being released between 97 and 98. And so it hyper-compressed the narrative and deviated at the ending from Ito's ending, which is more moves from body horror to cosmic horror.
It's a very Lovecraftian ending. And also it's the sort, that's where it gets into the kind of Lovecraftian horror that would be very, very difficult to adapt into live action.
And this is...
especially in 2000.
Part of the... my optimism for the Uzumaki adaptation in anime is that the episodes might build towards a satisfying conclusion because they're consecutive. I think the other sort of one-off, sometimes two stories in one episode model, the way that Ito uses panels to build suspense, to have big splash page reveals with jump scares after knowing exactly how many panels are going to build up to the reveal, it allows you to meditate on the meaning of the story. Your own mind fills in the gaps of the eerie silence as you're reading. I found all of the other adaptations unsatisfying.
Absolutely. And before we get strictly onto that, I just want to get your first impression. So you're talking very positively so far. So how, seeing as this has been your first time reading and experiencing his stories, how has your first impressions been?
Yeah, I thought the artwork was very impressive. I thought the use of panel compositions was as good as I have seen in some of the best of Western comics. I wouldn't be averse to picking this up and putting it in my own library. And unlike with Berserk, where, again, I like the artwork and I like the storytelling style, it made me feel uncomfortable in a way which was suitable to genre, whereas I felt that Berserk sometimes took it a bit too far, and even though probably accurately depicted the horrors that would take place in a dark fantasy scenario, it felt that it indulged too much in the suffering, whereas this was designed to creep and gross you out, and so it didn't feel indulgent. I don't know if I'm describing that properly.
I understand what you mean. The expectation going into a horror story makes the events that happen in all of these, despite the fact that there is a significant amount of suffering, almost every single one of his characters is doomed from the outset without knowing it to begin with. That all builds to the horror, so it feels appropriate. Whereas while I love Berserk, and you had some real peaks and valleys with that, especially the Golden Age, obviously, when it was going into the more high fantasy aspects of it. I remember you really enjoyed that. And by the end of Conviction, there was a lot that was starting to build in the story that you could grasp hold of and see as more positive than a purely dark and depressing vision. But I can definitely understand that Berserk, for a lot of people, is very, very difficult.
Eclipse felt exploitative in a way that nothing in Junji Ito, while gross and invasive, got to, if that makes sense.
Yes. And to touch on a point that I was building to a few minutes ago, Ito himself, in his manner, his style of work, reminds me, and of course this is where I'm going to go with it, a bit of David Lynch, if only because of the fact that, like Lynch, he's this nice, normal man who you could see him as a friendly grandfather.
Have you heard that Lynch isn't leaving the house at the moment because he's so petrified of getting COVID?
He's almost 80 at this point and he's not doing very well. There's been rumor that he's not well enough to direct anymore, because I know he was working on projects. He has dispelled those rumors, and I would assume that, given modern technology, he can probably direct remotely, or at least do some part of the process that doesn't require him to be on set every single day. I'm always excited for his works. By the way, my point that was I was making was, he goes, yeah, I'm a normal, friendly guy. Also, check out my work. It's really dark and messed up.
The comparison that I made while reading Uzumaki was with Stephen King, where Stephen King, and you can attribute a lot of this to being hit by a car and having a complete personality change, but Stephen King was from quiet, mild-mannered Maine, and then from his mind spawns all of these prolific horror concepts, even if they aren't executed with rhetorical flourish or great endings. And I think Uzumaki especially has real parallels to it, and I found it quite interesting because it was translated into Japanese and published in 1991, and you can see parallels in the story that, again, I don't know if Uzumaki has ever spoken about, but you've got the well at the center of the town being afflicted by a curse. And something that's quite interesting is that this episode is being recorded 27 years after Uzumaki was originally released. So we've got a nice little parallel with it and us discussing
it. Oh, yes, yes. And with that, let's start to get into the stories, because I think we've given enough peripheral. Although there is one other thing that I just wanted to give a little anecdote about how it was that I got into Ito in the first place, which was about 8 or 9 years ago, I wanted to dip my toe into horror storytelling and knew that Japan had its own unique flavor. Because Japanese horror, because of the cultural perspectives that it brings and the style that the authors tend to go with, feels so different. So I decided to go into a Manchester comic shop called Traveling Man and picked up that edition right there that you've got for however much it was, because it was only just released, only just translated into English and released in this large omnibus volume. And I find it funny now because Traveling Man, I don't really go there anymore when I'm in Manchester because it's plastered. All of the walls, all of the windows, pride flags, trans flags. And if you go in there, the Western comic section is entirely confined to a small corner, a few shelves that all have everything bunched up together, Marvel, DC, Image, Dark Horse. And the rest of the shop is either manga, they've got a big manga display in the middle, and then Funko Pops and boy toys, you know, essentially. And I always think to myself, I wonder if the people who staff that shop ever wonder, as they're putting up all of their trans flags and pride flags, why it is that the Western comics just don't sell anymore. Why is it people don't buy them anyway?
I know these were released in sort of like late 90s to 2000s, but none of this is contaminated by the current thing as well. So if anyone is interested in picking up just well-crafted escapist entertainment with an underlying subtext that relates to cyclical history or Japanese politics, I can endorse that these are worth the price. And shockingly, they're quite affordable. Like, they're only about 20-odd quid on Amazon compared to the omnibus formats from Marvel and DC that's 80 to 100, which, yeah, admittedly, I still spend money on the show.
They look really nice on the shelf, all right? You've got to have your shelf candy.
It depends on the story. If you're going to collect Swamp Thing in an omnibus format, I'm a sucker for it.
Yeah. So let's start. I think the easiest place to start would be the short stories. And this is a really good place to start because it contains some of his more iconic ones like Fashion Model and Hanging Blimp, adapted into Hanging Balloon. It also contains Painter, as you mentioned, is the introduction for many people to the Tomy, or Tome, however you pronounce it, series, which I also have, but I've not read because, like you, I wasn't quite as drawn to that story when I was going through this. And it seems Tomy is much more structured as similar to the first half of Uzumaki, a series of short stories all focusing on the same group of characters, particularly Tomy herself, who always gets into similar scenarios. Now,
the innovation of Tomie is that it follows the monster rather than the characters being subject to external forces or some kind of curse. And I think Ito has a particular connection to it because in 1987, he submitted his first proper manga story to a magazine for a Halloween edition and won a prize for it. And that was the first Tomie story that he did. So then he decided to continue it as a running series.
And it is his longest running series. And I have flipped through the edition. And if you go to that first story, you can see just how primitive his artwork was at that point, compared to where it would end up just a few years later, because there's a real, even in Shiver, you can see the difference in quality of artwork between different stories depending on when it is that they were published. And I do think that Uzumaki, and particularly Gyo, when you get to that late 90s to early 2000s period, is really when his artwork starts to hit its stride. It had been excellent up to that point, and obviously he was always amazing at crafting unnerving images, but that's when the detailed meshed with the ideas, meshed with the technique to really create something that stands out as something special. In fact, I'd say Gyo alone is some of the best horror artwork or artwork of any kind I've seen in most stories. The level of detail put into it is remarkable. But so in Shiver, we've got, a collection of short stories, and it goes from things like Used Record, which I thought was quite a good one. That's a good opener because it really doesn't indulge in the gore or the disturbing imagery. It's more of that conceptual horror where a girl, it's very, very simple, as you would expect with short stories. A girl ends up accidentally killing her friend after she attempts to steal a record from her because this record has this enchanting song that you can't get anywhere else. It's very rare. There's no label on it. And it seems to cut in halfway through a recording. It's a woman's lone voice singing a cappella, this haunting melody. And nobody knows where it came from and nobody knows what the record is of, but it seems to have an enchanting effect on the people who listen to the music that makes them obsess over it. So you have these themes of obsession, which tend to crop up a lot throughout Ito's work. It also has a particular theme in this one, which is that jazz is evil. Which I don't necessarily disagree with, because
what did he mean by this?
It's a jazz melody. Shockingly enough, none of Ito's stories, as far as I can tell, contain any diversity whatsoever. They're all Japanese.
One thing I will say about the record thing, obviously it's meant to be akin to a kind of siren song, that is possessing people as soon as they hear it and driving them to listen to it endlessly and disregard human life and their own safety in order to pursue it. But it did remind me, and this happened after, I believe, the record story was put out. But did you ever hear about the Bjork Stalker?
I've heard of it, but refresh my memory.
So Dankula's done a fantastic video on it that is really unsettling. It's like watching a real life Joaquin Phoenix's Joker. This Hispanic heritage guy gets obsessed with Icelandic singer Bjork, who is quite neotenous. She's quite childlike, and she has a very similar voice to the one that's implied in the record story and then is actually sung in the adaptation. And it's almost like watching, over the course of him filming himself getting obsessed with this woman and wanting to punish her with like an acid bomb for dating someone other than him, and then eventually killing himself. It's like watching a real life version of that. So the idea that someone can become so obsessed with a melody, particularly that strange, haunting, childlike melody that like Bjork would sing, or in that, to then drive them to hurt other people and themselves, it's unsettling, and it has happened. So Ito seems to be tapping into real and visceral and possible things. But that's why his body horror is so unsettling for me.
Well, he said in many interviews himself that his inspiration mainly comes from the everyday world around him, because there is so much mundane and almost monotonous things that we take for granted that you can find and, in a way, twist them into something unexpected, unusual, disturbing. And on that story that you just told, you've reminded me as well, it's slightly different, but still of the same character of what you described, was there was a band in the 90s called Pantera, who were a very famous heavy metal band. They split up in the year 2000 after releasing their last album. And then they all went their separate ways, and their guitarist and drummer, who were brothers, formed another band called Damage Plan. It turned out that there was an obsessive, crazy, schizophrenic fan of Pantera who had developed an obsession with them and also developed the delusion that they had been stealing musical ideas from his head. So that these ideas for riffs and songs would pop up in his head, and all of a sudden, oh, Pantera stole that from me. And so he thought that they were basically excavating his mind to steal ideas. And he went so crazy with this that when the band Damage Plan, the follow-up band, were playing, I think, near his town, he ends up going there with a gun and shoots Dimebag Darrell and a few other members of the audience, no other members of the band. He shoots Dimebag Darrell dead on stage. And I think he got took out by the security. So yeah, music has this really otherworldly and obsessive effect on a lot of people. It's one of the reasons that so many people love music so much, but it can be the danger that comes with any of these things that people really love artistically. And that's the interesting thing about the story, is that the song itself comes after the singer has died. She gets hit by a car, manages to drag herself into the studio that she was going to, and dies in the studio, and then begins singing the song. So it also taps into that idea that a lot of people have, certainly as a creative musical person myself, that you're not the one writing the music. You're a conduit that absorbs the music and these ideas from some otherworldly spiritual plane. But evidently, within this story, the music is coming from a malevolent force.
Well, there's two things on that. One, you'll remember which band it was. Was it AC/DC that they accused if you played a certain song?
Judas Priest.
Judas Priest, that was it. That they were inciting their followers to commit suicide or
that's happened
themselves.
With a few bands. Led Zeppelin, for instance, it was said that if you play Stairway to Heaven backwards, that you've got lyrics praising Satan, you can play the song backwards. I mean, it's not an enjoyable experience, but there's no secret messages there. Same with Judas Priest songs. Again, it's people putting their own interpretations onto these things and trying to draw it out into the real world.
Well, that kind of obsessiveness, particularly among groupies and teenage girl fans, manifested in things like Cuts for Bieber when we were growing up.
I remember that, yeah.
But then the other thing that you made me think of is that the idea that they have recorded her voice after she's died, that her death rattle can become some kind of melody that they can then monetize and sell on, has been the complaint of a lot of people in the music industry, that the music industry is exploitative. We only need to think of Michael Jackson, where Sony drove him to bankruptcy after he cancelled the Invincible tour because of the insensitivities of 9/11, Invincible being the most expensive record to have been produced at that time. And then after he dies, they quickly acquire his Elvis Beatles catalogue and his own catalogue and start releasing old tracks that he never wanted to put out, including remixing his songs for the Escape album with people like Justin Timberlake and augmenting his musical intent to keep profiting off of his corpse. And it's rather morbid, but it's something that the music industry does do. And I think that hints at that in that story.
Yes, absolutely. And to draw to expand on that point as well, with Michael Jackson, didn't they do the hologram tour?
They've done the same thing for ABBA now as well, haven't they?
They've done the same thing for Ronnie James Dio.
Tupac
as well. It's very morbid. I can't imagine if I'd been in the crowd feeling comfortable watching essentially a shadow on the wall version of a dead artist going through the motions purely for the sake of monetizing the record labels who own their image. And with the music, it's the same. Frank Zappa, one of my favorite artists, he died in 1995. And I think more albums of his have been released since then than he released in his lifetime. And bear in mind, he released over 60 albums in his own lifetime. And all of this is throwaway cutting room floor material that evidently if he'd wanted releasing, he would have released. He released enough bloody material in his life to get out basically most of what he wanted out there. So I think that's interesting that such a short story we could draw so much from, but that's the effect of a horror, I think, especially short and condensed horror. And so, yeah, it's a nice, unsettling story. If we move on to the next one, the one that the collection is named after, Shiver, I think this touches on some themes that we'll talk about more with Gyo, because this was one of the more notable ones for me, if only because of the imagery that's used in it, which really hits on, I think it's trypophobia, the fear of holes, particularly holes in your own body, because one of the recurring visuals throughout this is that the main character is living next to a girl with holes all in her arms. What's got you smirking?
I have not had a fear of holes in many women's bodies before, Harry. I don't know what you're talking about.
I don't know. Maybe you're a braver man than I, true. Clearly. I mean, if it was on her arm, I'd be freaked out.
Yeah, pretty strange. No. The most disturbing part of this story is the granddad's diary when he starts describing all of the insects that are somehow linked to the jade carving crawling around inside him. That really unsettles me, yeah.
So it turns out the reason for it is that there's a cursed jade carving which has been thrown into the next door neighbor's garden, which has cursed their daughter. And the reason for that carving existing in the first place, if I recall, is because the grandfather during World War II managed to find it and kept a hold of it before he ended up dying due to it, and he ended up throwing it out of the window before he died because it was an affliction that nobody in the family could understand. And again, this all touched on more in Gyo, but it seems to relate back to the idea of World War II guilt over atrocities, guilt over crimes committed, the idea that an entire generation of Japanese men in particular were cursed through their involvement in the conflict, and that this is now being passed on to their descendants. And this does seem to be a pathology that affects quite a few Japanese people. Ito comments on it quite a bit, not in his interviews that I could see, although you might have seen some different interviews than I have. But it seems to go one of two ways in Japan. either a trauma relating to guilt or a trauma relating to the fire bombings and nuclear bombs that have been dropped. Because it's a theme that runs through a lot of manga and anime that I've seen. Akira starts with the nuclear bomb being dropped on New Tokyo. So in that universe, Tokyo had been nuked. They rebuilt it and then it got nuked again. And it's all set after the fallout of that, because obviously being nuked does things to a country's mass psyche, especially one as conformist and as a collective in its culture as Japan. And then also, I've not watched it, but you've watched it, haven't you? Grave of the Fireflies.
There's all throughout Ghibli, there is a lot of nuclear annihilation imagery. You can go and watch my two-part conversation with former employee John Wheatley there, where I was much more bright-eyed and bushy-tailed back in the day. But
weren't we all?
Yeah, quite. In Nausicaa, Valley of the Wind, there are these ohms, these giant moving cephalopod-like bugs from prehistoric times that crawl over the nuclear wasteland eating radiation. And in order to defeat them, they resurrect the fire giants, an extinct race that can cause nuclear mushroom clouds to expand. In Totoro, famously, it's meant to be a sort of parallel 1960s Japan where the fallout of the war did not impact Japan and debilitate it as much, and actually they preserved the countryside rather than building on top of it to create places like Tokyo in the hills. And when they're cultivating trees, they grow them up to be the shape of the mushroom cloud. Grave of the Fireflies was an autobiographical text. It was adapted from a short story where the victims of the fire bombings of Japan, the sort of civilians who weren't involved in it, were two children whose mother was burned alive and sent to live with an aunt who didn't provide them enough rations. So they move out to an old war bunker, and you see the most harrowing, slow starvation of a young girl and eventually her older brother, who dies in a train station holding her remains. I recommend everyone watch it. It's one of the best films I've ever seen.
No wonder everybody who's watched it has told me that it is harrowing.
Man, I cried. It's brutal. But it's even in the most optimistic of anime from Ghibli, because Grave of the Fireflies and Totoro released as a double billing. And depending on which way round you watch them...
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, it's the original Barbenheimer. It's brutal.
Because I've watched My Neighbor Totoro, and it's... It's not a miserable film. It's quite a pleasant, fun, happy-go-lucky film.
It's basically got no plot. It's pure vibes. And it's pure, we're happy. Yeah, Alice in Wonderland.
If I remember, it's mainly about a little girl going to a bus stop near her home and finding that there is a big magical creature there who she becomes friends with. And that's the entire film.
They move to rural Japan and they discover in the bushes there is a giant friendly rabbit and a series of smaller other troll-like rabbits.
Even you just describing it is making me smile because it's so pleasant.
And then the other film they show it with is, here's a three-year-old girl who starves to death slowly because of the Japanese intervention in the war.
I'd rather have Fireflies first and then Totoro as a nice, you know, palate cleanser.
I don't know. It would feel offensive if it was following it. But point being, the nuclear Armageddon looms large in the mind of the Japanese, and also the firebombings of Tokyo, which claimed more lives overall.
More destructive.
Yeah, so it's not just the horrors of war that are inflicted on the civilians and bystanders, but also the guilt for the Japanese involving themselves in the war and the things that were done. And I think this story, particularly Shiva, it alludes to something that, and this is my conspiratorial hat on here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if Ito has a family secret of his own pertaining to the war. Because when we get onto Gyo, there was an interview that I read where he said that this was inspired by two things. Gyo was inspired by the shark attack scenes in Jaws and stories that his parents had told him about the war. And the submerged ship that was full of these plague-bearing mechanized
legs.
Things that run on gas that hijack a
living creature.
Deteriorating corpse, yeah. This seems to have come from a Unit 731 mission that sought to load up biological weapons and send them at the US, but then the submarines ended up being sunk. Why would his family have necessarily known about that?
Mm.
It's the same thing of, is there a family secret here to do with things that were done during the war?
Well, he was born in the 60s, so I could hazard a guess that at the very least he'd probably have a grandfather, if not his own father, who was involved in the war on the Japanese side, of course.
And Unit 731 is by far the worst and most atrocious unit of the Japanese military. They subjected, I think it was 14,000 men, women, and children to vivisections, torture, various bodily experiments, seeing the effect of what frostbite does to living limbs, and then over 300,000 people total were killed by their biological weapons. And if that is the example it's based on, because it seems very similar, how would he have known if it wasn't a family story? And so the idea that there are family secrets following the war, and this is inflicted with a burden of being sworn to secrecy onto younger generations, like the girl who is born with these holes in her body that she's breathing through.
And she can't understand why, because nobody has told her, nobody even realizes the jade carving is in the garden.
Exactly. Nobody necessarily admits to the secrets lurking in your own backyard. Is this a personal thing for Ito? We don't actually know.
Well, we know in the same way that Nietzsche said that all philosophy is confession, in a certain way, all storytelling is confession, because as much as we can admit, and I do think that there's a lot of stock, I put a lot of stock into what I described in the used record, that you are almost acting as a conduit for ideas that are being transmitted to you.
It's like the Geist idea that momentarily the gods might strike you with divine inspiration, so the Roman poet must get it out here and now in case that inspiration flees from him before he can transcribe it.
If you would like to see the full version of this premium video, please head over to lotuseaters.com and subscribe to gain full access to all of our premium content.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.